to the court, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Thomas Riley. I'm one of the co-counsel, Ann Hayden. Douglas County Public Defender's Office are here on behalf of the appellant, Chris Garza, who's appealing the resentencing that was dictated by Miller versus Obama and the Vantage and Castaneda cases. Our position is that the sentence that was imposed by the trial court, which is 90 to 90 on the homicide and 6 2/3 to 20 for the use of a knife, is a de facto life sentence and violates the strictures of Miller and Montgomery versus Louisiana. Secondly, even if the court does not agree that it's a de facto life sentence, that the sentence is still excessive. In the wake of this court's rulings and the Miller case, the legislature retooled the sentencing structure for juveniles that were convicted of homicide.
Counsel, in connection with this appeal, are you claiming any aspect of that new sentencing statute is unconstitutional?
That it violates the Miller and Montgomery requirement. Yes, that our position is that Miller and Montgomery require, first of all, you'd have to determine, as other courts have, that a 96 to 120 year sentence is a de facto life sentence. And then we think that kicks in the Montgomery requirements that, and again, other courts have said this, that unless there's a specific finding by the sentencing court that the defendant is one of the uncommon, rare people who demonstrates irreparable corruption or depravity, that a sentence of life or de facto life is inappropriate.
So to be clear, are you claiming that any of the elements, any of the mitigating factors under the new sentencing statute were not considered by the trial court?
What I'm saying to you is that the statutory requirements for the sentencing were not followed specifically by the court, and more importantly, along those lines, it's clear that this statute contemplates a significant evidentiary hearing on the sentencing of juveniles for homicide. We presented evidence of from a neuropsychologist, adolescent neuropsychologist, who talked about the science, which is irrefutable, and the state even admitted on the record that they didn't dispute the science on the lack of maturation of the brain. Secondly, we had a psychologist examine the defendant who had been in prison for 26 years and was 16 at the time of the offense. And he was subjected to lengthy examination and cross-examination, during which time the record clearly shows that he evaluated all the risk factors, including those statutory requirements. He went through one by one, and that as a result, that the defendant who hasn't had he's been in prison and since 1993 has one right.
Counsel, you
yes.
Your argument is that 96 years in prison is not a meaningful opportunity for a release.
That's correct.
What is your definition of a meaningful opportunity?
Well, obviously, we can't put a bright line rule number on that. I think we have to consider.
Okay, but in this case, what do you think it is?
What I think it is in this case? I think that the defendant, based on his record and the evidence that has been presented, that serving 30 years in prison, which is a 60-year sentence under our law, would give him a reasonable opportunity for parole. I'm not saying that the high end should be, I'm not saying it should be 60 to 60, but 90 to 90 and then the consecutive 60 to 30 to 20. He'll be out for parole when he's 65 years old.
Do you call that, some of the cases are calling it a geriatric release?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Connecticut Supreme Court, the Washington Supreme Court, and I believe one other that you may have cited, have indicated that a sentence, for instance, in Connecticut, sentence given to a juvenile 50 years who would have done a similar parole eligibility, 25 or so, was a de facto life sentence and didn't give a meaningful opportunity for release. That's what the Connecticut Supreme Court did. This, obviously, these cases are coming down every day. As a matter of fact, in reference to the Montgomery case, yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court sent back five cases to the state of Arizona. And I'll give you the site. It's Tatum versus Arizona, 2016 Westlaw, 1381849. And basically, what had happened is these guys were resentenced under the Miller-Montgomery. And the court said, unless the sentencing court makes a specific finding that the defendant is one of these persons who is irretrievably broken, for lack of a better term, that a sentence of life or de facto life is unconstitutional.
The court didn't talk about de facto life.
I'm saying that. The court did not, in that case that I'm talking about, those were life sentences.
All life without
parole. The Arizona cases were life sentences. I don't know if they were life without parole, they were life sentences.
The ones yesterday.
From yesterday, yes. Yes. What I'm saying is that life or de facto life.
If we agree with...
We haven't reached that de facto life sentence issue yet. They're going to, obviously.
If we agreed with you that this was a de facto life sentence, could we make that determination? Could this court make that determination on excessive depravity or whatever the...
I think under our statute you can, and or you have the alternative of remanding it to the sentencing court and directing the sentencing court to make factual findings, as the cases that I cited from other states require, factual written findings as to why the life sentence or de facto life sentence is justified under Montgomery's requirement that there be a finding of...
What do you base the idea that the trial court should make factual determinations?
The cases from other states that I cited have made reference to that. Said that if there's going to be a finding of irreparable depravity or corruption,
with those cases,
there has to be a factual basis for it, and the court should... I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
What were those cases based on? Constitutions of those states, or
no? These are all based on the Miller-Montgomery series of cases in the United States Supreme Court. Based on the Eighth Amendment.
The United States Supreme Court has never said that, have they?
It said
that there should be a specific findings by the trial court judge?
They haven't said it yet, but in Sotomayor's, or Justice Sotomayor's opinion yesterday on the granting of cert, she's pretty much directing them to do that in Arizona. They don't come back here with these life sentences unless you make findings consistent with Montgomery and that give a basis for the finding of irreparable depravity. And that's Sotomayor's opinion on this Tatum versus Arizona. And
but again, that was a life sentence, not a de facto life sentence.
Those were life sentences. Basically what happened...
So those cases aren't controlling this case at this time, is that correct?
This is not
a life sentence case.
It's
de facto life sentence, which is
different
than... Well,
I'd say a rose is a rose under any other name. If you give someone 150 years in prison...
Well, then define the rose.
How can you look at someone and say that's not a life sentence?
Counsel, define for us what the rose is. Give me the parameters of a de facto life sentence. How would you define that?
One that doesn't give an individual an opportunity to be released within a reasonable period of time, is the language. You're asking me to put a specific number on it. In this case, I think that a sentence of 60 years, which would make him eligible for parole in 30, based on the only evidence that's presented at the evidentiary hearing.
So what does the trial court consider? It considers how the prisoner has conducted himself during the sentence that he's served.
Yes.
Up to the time that he's now being...
Well, the evidence was presented on that. The judge's findings...
But what about the actual criminal act that the prisoner committed?
That's obviously part of the determination. The record for the trial was presented as part of the record in the sentence. But all these cases...
You would concede that this murder was exceptionally depraved, wouldn't you?
He didn't make any finding along those lines.
Well...
Do you think the record's sufficient to make that kind of a finding?
I don't think... The question is whether the crime is... That's only part of the equation, whether the crime was excessively depraved. The question is whether the defendant is irretrievably depraved. And the answer to that, by 26 years of imprisonment, is clearly no.
That's your main basis for the fact that he should have a lesser sentence.
No. My main basis, that's well, part of it.
Well, that's the only basis you could have, considering... That would be the only basis you could have, considering that the only other fact would be the facts surrounding the crime.
No, the other facts are the psychological evaluation done by the psychologist that is contemplated by our statute that says he is not dangerous currently. The fact that the penitentiary itself has said that he is not in need of any mental health treatment or any services. He's ready for release. And maybe that's the answer to the question of when is the situation such that he should be released. When the prison says he's done everything we can ask and he's done everything well, there's nothing else we can do. He's just going to sit there. We've just locked him
up.
So
he's a model prisoner, even according to the
system. So since 1993.
So a sentence of incarceration is only to rehabilitate the offender?
Well, I think that when the Supreme Court says that children are different, that's what they're talking about. And they're not saying that it shouldn't be punishment. I'm 30 years imprisonment is punishment. So I'm not trying to minimize that. But I am saying to you that the Supreme Court is very serious about these issues. Obviously, they took Montgomery, they took Miller, they took Roper. Now they're picking these Arizona cases and say, get this right. So they're when they said that children are different, they meant it. And I think that's the direction that they're giving to the state courts to apply these factors. And to just say, this is a terrible crime, and it exemplifies a horrible, wicked mind at the time. Those Arizona cases, that's what they said. And the judge Sotomayor said, that's why they're going back.
Isn't it quite possible that the defendant's or a defendant's performance in prison could be rationally related to a desire for early release and not speak at all to the defendant's depravity or what he or she would do upon release?
It absolutely could, except here's what we have in this case, Your Honor. We have someone who when he was sentenced, had no hope of release. So his good conduct was based not on some hope of getting early out. He spent from 1993 in prison with one write-up. And what, Miller came down in 2012? So for 16 years, he had no hope. So to say that his basis is a hope of early release, but has absolutely no application in this case.
Even under your scenario, he could have been building a record for the Board of Pardons.
Yeah, and that's about as likely as me getting struck by lightning, with all due respect. Any other questions? I'm over time. I appreciate the board allowing me to answer the questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Vincent, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Garza claims the sentence imposed by the district court is the functional equivalent of life without parole and violates Miller because the district court did not make a specific finding that Garza was irreparably corrupt. In any event, the record does not support such a finding. We submit those claims are without merit. Garza first claims the sentence amounts to life without parole and will not be eligible for parole until he's 64, and because 64 is his projected life expectancy, he will not receive an opportunity to release required by Miller. We disagree. Notably, Garza presented no evidence to the district court showing his projected life expectancy was only 64, which I note is quite a bit lower than the CC data, which district courts typically use. Furthermore, it's clear from the district court's decision.
There is at least one court, right, that uses tables, life expectancy tables?
Yeah, that's from what I've seen in the case, various cases that I've read, they either use the CC tables or some of them have them in the statutes. Some states actually have them.
Thank you.
It's clear from the district court's decision that it considered Garza's age in determining whether his sentence would afford him a meaningful opportunity for release. Had the district court intended for Garza to spend the rest of his life in prison, it could have imposed a sentence of life imprisonment. It did not. Had the district court sentenced him to a term of years that renders him parole eligible at 64, an age that several courts have found to be within a juvenile's natural life expectancy. Garza next claims the district court violated his constitutional rights by failing to explicitly find he was irreparably corrupt before it sentenced him to life imprisonment. This claim fails because the district court did not sentence Garza to life imprisonment. But even if it had, neither Miller nor 28-105.02 requires the district court to specifically find a juvenile as irreparably corrupt before sentencing him or her to life imprisonment. Rather, it is sufficient that the record supports such a finding. Finally, Garza claims the district court erred in sentencing him to life imprisonment because the record does not support a finding that he was irreparably corrupt. However, the district court did not find Garza as irreparably corrupt. Instead, the court acknowledged and gave credence to what appeared to be his changed ways, but nevertheless included a lengthy term of imprisonment warranted due to the nature of the crime and the horrific circumstances surrounding its commission. That decision is consistent with applicable case law. In both Graham and Miller, the Supreme Court recognized that murder differs from other serious offenses against the individual based on both moral culpability and consequential harm. And in Miller, the court further recognized that whereas here a juvenile commits a vicious murder, it is beyond question that he or she deserves severe punishment. And notably, neither Miller nor 28-105.02 purports to limit the district court's discretion in determining the weight to be given various sentencing factors. Moreover, a review of the record in this case supports the district court's decision. Garza was just 2 months shy of his 17th birthday when he brutally murdered Christina O'Day, an innocent 17-year-old girl. Nothing about the murder suggested Garza acted impulsively or failed to fully appreciate the consequences of his actions. To the contrary, he acted, the evidence showed that Garza planned the attack and spent the better part of 3 hours essentially torturing O'Day. The evidence showed that she was bound and gagged, raped and sodomized. She was beaten with a pneumatic door closer, strangled with an electrical cord, and eventually her wrist was slashed with a butcher knife. In addition, following the murder, Garza undertook multiple efforts to conceal the crime, which included disposing of property and lying to the police about his involvement. Garza's conduct was both calculated cruel, and given the amount of violence involved, he was deserving of severe punishment.
So what do we make of cases like the Iowa Supreme Court apparently has addressed the concept of de facto life? Should we take any of that into consideration?
Actually, Iowa, there were a couple of other states, I believe, Wyoming and possibly Connecticut, that have also made similar findings in citing Knoll, for finding that 50 doesn't provide it meaningful with the geriatric release kind of provision. But most of those cases dealt with whether the Miller protections were triggered and not necessarily whether the sentence itself was okay after they had gotten the Miller hearing. So I'm not sure about that, but I do know that Iowa has, starting in Knoll, they kind of veered off under their own constitution, and they've been there ever since. And I believe now they have outlawed life without parole, even for homicide offenders, and I think they've also outlawed all mandatory minimums as applied to juveniles.
So what they're doing is a product of their own constitution?
Well, that, you know, the Cassiano case is a little bit interesting because the court kind of drew the line at 50, but I should point out that was a hard 50. That was 50 years with no parole eligibility. And so if you want to compare a hard 50 in Connecticut to, you know, 96 here, we cut our sentences in half because we had a good time before. So technically he's under that cutoff.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want you to finish the Chief's question, but when you say a hard line, so the Connecticut court said 50 hard years, no more than that. Is that what you're saying they said?
Well, what they did was they said 50 constituted de facto life, and they wanted to send it back for a Miller hearing. And then they kind of hinted to the legislature that, you know, they declined to decide whether anything less than 50 would trigger Miller protections. That means it has to go back. But they were waiting for their legislature to enact a statute in response to Cassiano, which in fact it has done.
Okay.
And what they did there, I think they accepted that cutoff point because the way they set the statute up is if you get more than 10 but less than 50, then you have to serve 60% of it or 12 years before you're parole eligible, whichever is greater. But if the sentence is over 50 years, then they're parole eligible after serving 30. And there was recently a challenge to that statute, just in case you're interested. There was recently a challenge to that statute because somebody came in and said, hey, wait a second. Yeah, this isn't constitutionally sufficient. I'm entitled to a Miller hearing in these cases where I get individual consideration, and they rejected that claim. And it's State v. Williams Bay.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting. If you had anything else on the chief's question, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the point I was going to make was in their state, their legislature actually had passed a statute that says 60 is life imprisonment. And so what the court did in Cassiano was lower that to 50, and they were criticized by one of the dissenting judges for basically trumping the legislature. So I'm not sure exactly where that figure came from. And I don't know how these courts are going about deciding where the requisite cutoff is. Natural life expectancy, there's a split of authority. There are a lot of courts that go with just natural life expectancy, they have CDC tables, and then they take it from there. When are you going to be eligible for parole? That's the way a number of courts in Florida have done it. And other states that have, New Jersey, for example, other states that have their life expectancy tables. But that's how they determine. As far as giving you any kind of concrete guidelines or cutoffs, I can't give you any hard rules. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you confirm the decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? No time for rebuttal. On we'll go to State versus Douglas M. Mantich. Mr. Sipple, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please you to court.